Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Thursday, July 18th, 2013. I'm Holly Keen, and this is Raven News. Sitka National Historical Park is warning the public about a recent bear sighting. Chief Ranger Karen Farley says the bear was spotted Sunday night around 10:30 p.m. near the park's entrance on Sawmill Creek Road. Trails at the park remain open, but warning signs are posted. Officials remind the public to make noise on the trails and exercise caution. If a bear is encountered, walk slowly backward, but do not run. Bear sightings in the park should be reported to the front desk at 747-0110. Elsewhere in Sitka, the police department will take bear reports through their business line. That phone number is 747-3245. An event in Sitka this week is exploring our ability as a species to respond to change. Nine women from around the country are meeting here to talk about resilience. They are not scientists, rather they are writers, poets, and essayists. Carolyn Servid, co-director of Sitka's Island Institute, organized the discussion, which she's calling the Literature of Resilience. Servid says the topic of resilience emerged from her organization's initial interest in sustainability. The name doesn't really matter.
It's all about the capacity to adapt to change.
Servid says resilience is an appropriate topic for writers. She defines the term as thriving in times of turbulence. There may be many reasons why humans may or may not thrive when faced with change. Servid believes creativity and imagination are critical.
If you think about what it takes to adapt to change, you have to imagine new scenarios. You have to imagine new ways to do things and new ways to tackle things. And that's, for me, the intersection with writing, is that it's hugely about the imagination and where we can see ourselves and how we can create. I mean, the idea here is to explore possible new stories that might be useful as we move forward. The planet's changing. Our lives are going to be changing.
Nine established writers, all women, are in Sitka for 3 days of discussion on the topic. Friday evening, they'll share their ideas with the public in readings and performance. Lori Cutchins is a poet and teacher from Virginia. As a cancer survivor, she understands better than most our species' capacity for resilience. She says the intense creativity of the three-day session and the final readings produce a tension that is healthy for her work.
There's a craftsperson within me that is thinking about every choice along the way and trying to become as conscious as possible about what is being birthed, what's being born. And I never feel like I'm in charge. It always feels like there's something, like the poem itself or the essay itself is actually directing me, and I have to learn how to listen to it. That's my job, is to listen deeply.
The public can listen to what the nine writers create about the idea of resilience at a public reading, 7:30 p.m. Friday in the Del Shirley Hospitality Room in Allen Hall on the Sitka Fine Arts Campus. Early returns of hatchery chum salmon have meant a good start to Southeast Alaska's commercial net fisheries this summer. The Purse Seine fleet has been hauling in dog salmon returning to the hatcheries in the northern and central part of the region. Meanwhile, the gillnet fleet has been catching a mixed bag in the opening weeks of the season, but hatchery chums have been the catch in Lynn Canal and nearly Juneau. As Joe Vicnicki reports from Petersburg, as the chum runs slow down, the fleet is turning its attention and its optimism to pinks.
The total catch for Southeast commercial fishing fleets by the end of the second week in July topped 8.5 million salmon, with nearly 5 million of those chums. Those dogs have been overall the most lucrative salmon species in the region in recent years, and every gear group is getting in on that action. Southeast Purse Seine fleet has been fishing for 2 days a week, Thursdays and Sundays, and boats have had a choice for hatchery chums this year, Hidden Falls east of Sitka or Amalga Harbor north of Juneau. Steve Reifenstuhl is general manager of the Sitka-based Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, which owns the Hidden Falls hatchery on eastern Baranof Island. Seine fishing started in Fish and Game's statistical week 25, and Reifenstuhl notes the Hidden Falls chums showed up early and in big numbers.
In week 25, it was the most fish we'd ever seen in our entire history at Hidden Falls, and then week 26 was the second largest week we'd ever seen. I still wasn't thinking it was going to be a huge run. I was just thinking it was early. I mean, it's always nice to think it's going to be huge, but sometimes it's just early, and that's what it appears it is in early peak. but it's got a longer tail than I was thinking it might have.
Reifenstuhl expects to meet NSERA's forecast of 1.3 million chums at Hidden Falls. Boats not heading to Hidden Falls have had openings at Amalga Harbor, catching chums returning to the Juneau-based Douglas Island Pink and Chum, or DIPAC. Executive Director Eric Prestigard says the fleet had a huge opening there July 4th, saying catches in Amalga Harbor have dropped since then, but Prestigard says DIPAC has already hit its chum forecast and is hoping for more.
We were forecasting about 2.7 million, our point estimate, 2.7 million chums. We can easily account for that already. Was a very early start, definitely a strong early start to the run this year, and it seems like just about everybody's getting some of them.
Everybody, meaning all gear groups, with the troll fleet topping 300,000 chums in the home shore area of Icy Strait, and strong DIPAC chum catches for the gillnet fleets in Taku Inlet and Lynn Canal. Meanwhile, it's forecast to be another big year for pink salmon. Fish and Game is estimating a commercial catch of 54 million humpies this summer. Bill Davidson, Regional Salmon Management Coordinator for Fish and Game, says so far the fish are cooperating.
The pinks are showing up as we would expect. Maybe some different patterns are going to evolve out of this season with where they show up, but the pinks seem to be there, and we're just early into the run, and the chums are likewise kind of, I think, roughly on track.
233 seine boats landed fish in the second week in July, helping Southeast pink catch reach 2.9 million fish. The big catches of the peak pink season typically happen in late July and early August. Meanwhile, the gillnet fleet has been fishing for 3 or 4 days a week, depending on the areas. Gillnetters did not get to fish in the early season on king salmon returning to the transboundary rivers. Those are the Taku near Juneau and the Stikine near Wrangell. Davidson says weak Chinook returns have meant less fishing opportunity in places like District 6 and 8 around Petersburg and Wrangell.
Both of the two transboundary rivers there have been on the weak side as expected this year, and we've taken action. We opened up 6 and 8 late and had restrictions on area off the river mouth to help conserve those fish.
Likewise, the gillnet fleet around the Taku has seen restrictions. The in-season forecast for that river is for a return of 19,000 kings. Managers are forecasting a return of about 22,000 on the Stikine. Despite weak forecasts, gillnetters in District 8 around Petersburg and Wrangell caught 1,000 king salmon the second week in July, with an average of 50 Chinook per boat. Overall, the second week in July saw gillnetters landing over 600,000 fish. 480,000 of those were chums, and most of those dogs were caught in districts 11 and 15 around Juneau and Lynn Canal. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
A strange white bird was photographed recently as it was feeding from tide pools near Cake. KRBD's Layla Carey found a local expert to identify the bird, which turns out to be a rare sight in Alaska, especially in Southeast.
Over the past 3 decades or so, there have been around 10 confirmed sightings in Southeast Alaska of the snowy white great egret. In early June, near the Southeast community of Cake, Jim Bechtel snapped some photos of the 11th. Bechtel, a geologist with the U.S. Forest Service, says he first considered whether the bird might be an albino heron, but with its black legs and other distinctive features, he decided it was some kind of egret.
Well, I'd worked in the South, and I thought I knew what it was, but knew that whatever that bird was, it was a long ways from home.
Bechtel sent photos of the bird to an expert he knew, but didn't hear back. Turns out the expert was out in the field. Ketchikan has numerous experts, too, including Steve Heinel, who works for the State Department of Fish and Game. After looking at a couple of Bechtel's pictures, Heinel quickly identified the species and says it's rarely seen in the 49th state.
On the West Coast, they breed as far north as central Washington. So this bird at Cake is very far out of range, and it's a very rare find.
Heinel says he's never seen one in person himself, and there are no great egret sighting records for Ketchikan. The great egret does resemble a great blue heron, which could be considered its cousin, and is a common bird in Southeast Alaska.
They're not quite as big, but they're a pretty big bird, and they're, you know, entirely white with black legs and a yellow bill, so they're pretty unmistakable.
Bechtel, who was based on Prince of Wales Island but had been in Cake for geology mapping work, says the bird was in that area at least 3 days. He adds that it seemed less skittish than the average heron.
But there was a large family having a barbecue on the beach, and the kids were running all about and playing out on the lower intertidal zone, and it seemed to not mind that much.
Bechtel says he was able to walk within about 40 yards of the bird. He notes that when it did take off, it didn't squawk the way herons often do. Because of their beautiful feathers, great egrets were hunted nearly to extinction in the late 19th century. That inspired some of the first laws in the United States to protect birds. The great egret also is the symbol of the National Audubon Society. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The groundbreaking ceremony for an educational facility in downtown Juneau for the study and sharing of Tlingit Haida and Tsimshian cultures has been set. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute says in a release that the ceremony for the Walter Sobolev Center will be held August 1st. The $20 million facility will be named the Walter Sobolev Center after the Tlingit leader, Dr. Walter Sobolev, who died in 2011. Institute officials say more than $15 million has been raised for the building, and fundraising efforts will continue during construction. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is hosting an open house of its Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. NOAA says the July 26th event is being held to recognize Stevens's contributions to Alaska's fisheries and to celebrate Ted Stevens Day. Stevens served in the U.S. Senate for 40 years and was revered for his ability to bring home projects and money. He died in a plane crash in Alaska in 2010. The following year, the legislature passed a measure setting aside the fourth Saturday of every July as Ted Stevens Day. It falls this year on July 27th. NOAA, in a release, says the Research Institute in Juneau is one of its leading science facilities. The open house will include tours and exhibits. And that's all for Raven News. You are listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka.